Good evening, friends of the Bulkley Valley and beyond. My name is Thomas Tom Roper, and you are listening to CICK, Smithers Community Radio, 93.9 on your FM dial. My program, On the Ropes, is broadcasting from the Cassia territory of the Gidimdum clan, home of the Wet'suwet'en.
Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We are opening our show tonight, On the Ropes. And tonight I have with me I call him a Smithereen fisherman, but he's a local man from our area, Eckert Mendel. Welcome aboard, Eckert.
Thank you.
And we're going to follow, we like that pattern of trying to figure out why people actually came to the valley, or whether they were born here, or whatever their process was. And we're hoping we can get a little bit of information of that from Eckert. And so, Eckert, as we follow that sort of line, I understand that you are from Kitimat originally. Is that true?
Yes. In the 50s, my parents were of German heritage, and my dad was looking for a job. He lived out in the bush before and worked at the sawmill, and it burnt down one night. So he came to Terrace and looked for a job, and Elkan was just flooding the reservoir at Utah Lake, and they were offering jobs to immigrants. So my dad got a job in Kitimat, and then we moved there in 1956. We moved to Kitimat.
Okay, 1956. So you were talking about where the sawmill burnt down. Was that in Canada, or was that back in Germany?
No, that was in Penny. They were just opened up. Lots of sawmills in the 50s were bush sawmills, small sawmills, and we lived in a town called Penny, the other side of Prince George, on the other side of the Fraser River, before the highway to Banff was built.
Oh, okay.
And then one night, the sawmill burnt down.
Right.
So, of course, the next day, everybody was unemployed.
Right. Was that a Northwood sawmill at the time, do you remember?
No, it was a small private company, but later was taken over by them.
Right, right. Because I've kind of been to that area. There's a really nice bridge going across the Fraser River to get over to that side.
Yeah, at that time, we were ordering our groceries on the train.
Okay.
Everything, there was no vehicles. Everything had to be done on the train. But there was lots of lumber near the water there, so it was cheap logging. You could haul logs really short distances, and it was cheap.
Yeah, right. No, it was a big area for quite a long time. Yeah. So when the family decided to move to Kitimat, like, it looked like it could be a very solid job at that time.
Yes, my dad was a little older, and so we were always worried about whether they'd give him employment.
Right.
But they liked immigrants because immigrants were kind of stuck there. They worked hard, most of them. They wanted a new start in Canada.
Right.
And Elkan was a high-paying job, you know, and they had lots of respect for new immigrants.
Right, which is really it's a really good thing. And immigrants do have that sort of, I would say, reputation that they want to get ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, they considered Canada a new chance in their lives.
Right.
Most of them weren't from Germanic background, which I'm from. Most of them were from the Azores.
Right.
And Portuguese, Italians and stuff.
But right.
You know, they were, and we all got along great.
Yeah, which is kind of so cool the way. That's one thing about Kitimat. It's a very international town.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Everybody respects everybody to a certain extent.
Yeah, you know, except the soccer games.
Yeah,
we all showed our colors at soccer games.
That's right. That's when it gets real tight.
Yeah.
On which country is going to lead the way for that year.
Yeah.
So being in Kitimat, Eckert, I mean, a place like that is it's a beautiful area. It's got tremendous recreational potentials and different things to do. Why would you wander out of there? Like, why did you not stay there?
When I graduated, I went to Mount Elizabeth School, and in grade 12 I graduated, and I wanted to do something in the forest, in the bush. My dad was trying to get me to apply at Elkan, and I said, no, I'm not really an Elkan guy. I want to work out in the wild.
Right, right.
So the forestry offered me a job in Smithers in 1967.
Okay.
And so I started working here. I love Smithers because it had a nice upcoming ski hill.
Right.
It had lots of natural recreation,
more
than Smithers, where you had a boat and went out in the ocean.
Yeah.
But things here were better. Chris Daly built a cabin up on Hudson Bay Mountain.
Yeah.
And everybody knew Chris Daly, and we all looked up to him doing,
back in the day, he was a he was a jumper.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember
he,
that?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
was,
and they actually built ski jumps.
Yeah, yeah. They had a huge
and
jump.
Competed.
The remnants were still here when we moved here.
Yeah.
The remnants of that jump you're talking about.
Yeah,
it was interesting to go look at it, though.
I can say really agree with that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like your family felt that same way, Eckhart, or was it just
my
you?
Family. What happened was in those years, is immigrants from Europe were the ones that brought skiing to most areas like this. We were all from European backgrounds where skiing was quite normal there.
Yeah.
But so-called other Canadians didn't really ski a lot. I remember in grade one, the teacher saying, well, how many people here ski? I pull out my hand really dramatically. And I was the only kid in grade one that put up his hand.
But about
in grade 10, the teacher asked how many kids skied. Almost every child put up their hand.
Right. Isn't that
a dramatic influx of stuff.
Very interesting. Yeah. That. Yeah. So your mom, she felt similar? Like she thought, well, I see more recreational opportunities in Smithers than in Kitimat?
No, she. We all lived in Kitimat. The jobs were in Kitimat.
Yeah.
And we were... My parents, my mom was quite educated, and when she came here, she could just get a job. She worked at the library at the high school. Later, she really liked the northern environment.
I mean, Kitimat
had lots of rain and stuff. She didn't like that so much. But we already had a ski hill started in Kitimat in the bush there called Clack Mountain, and my mom was pretty active there. And we had a ski hill in Kitimat right at the hospital hill in town. There was a little ski hill that Alcan provided for us.
Right.
But
right.
On weekends, we came to Smithers.
Yeah,
Smithers, backcountry skiing in Smithers, it's more powder snow. It's not heavy, wet snow.
Yeah.
So everybody knows that you want to ski powder, go to Smithers.
Yeah.
So we're on weekends, we're driving here with a Volkswagen to go ski in Smithers. Walking up, there was no road up Hudson Bay Mountain yet.
No.
We were walking up there with snowshoes.
Wow.
And then skiing down.
Right down that, area.
But we really looked upon Smithers as a better alpine area than Kitimat. You know.
Yeah, that's pretty. Well, it's got a lot to do with the moisture of living on the coast.
Yep,
it's a whole different environment. Yep. And we saw that even with Shames Mountain. They built that beautiful ski system there, but they can't keep snow too long, and then it rains, you know?
Yeah, no, and it's certainly the ski conditions on the alpine in Smithers are much better than Shames, or at that time we were skiing at Bornite Mountain, we were skiing at Mount Hayes and Prince Rupert, we were skiing at Clack Mountain and Kitimat, but we really loved Smithers better.
Right, right. So when you got the job in the bush, like that was the bush here in Smithers?
Yeah, I came here, I had an interview with the forestry, they liked me, and I started here on a cruising crew and worked in the bush. In those days it was just men or boys. We were boys. We were 18 years old.
Yeah.
Women hadn't entered into forestry yet. And we lived out at Babine for a while. We lived 1 year out at Maurice Lake, at Etna Lake, doing a cruise in the winters. You were expected to live in the bush, though, and we all liked that part.
Yeah,
We'd come to town on weekends if we're lucky, and sometimes not even on weekends.
Right.
You know, we lived in the bush, and it was good. Pay was really low, but you always got paid. We were all on salary. I was at $90 a month.
$90 a month.
Which was normal, was about $500 a month.
Yeah.
We were a fifth of normal.
Yeah.
We
were being paid. So there was a little bit of underpay in there, but you did have a pretty
but
nice lifestyle.
We loved it.
Yeah.
And we were all bush guys. We loved the bush, all of us.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. That was actually one of the things when I worked out at Huckleberry. We were out in camp, and it was just you've got so much recreation around you.
Yeah.
As long as you can put the effort in after work, it's tremendous, really.
Yeah, we didn't really start. I know they always had a boat out there, and I was always going out when we were out at Babine. I'd get up at 5 o'clock, go fishing for a couple hours, and I had to work.
Exactly. That's all we get, 2 hours, but it's better than no hour.
I loved it.
Yeah, exactly.
I loved it.
So, Eckhart, when on our show, we always try to throw a few songs along, just because we're connected with radio.
Okay.
And being that I've kind of leaning on you being a fisherman and giving us a little more fishing stories, I wanted to start out with this one here. This band, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, have been around for, I can't believe it, but they're going on their 60-year reunion tour.
All right.
And they're going to try and call it their farewell trip.
Okay.
But they've played in Kitimat before, they've played in Smithers before, and they played in Prince George. Okay. So it's a Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, and we'll take a shot at this, one of our old-time favorite songs.
Sounds good.
Lazy yellow moon coming up tonight, shining through the trees. Crickets are singing and lightning bugs are floating on the breeze. Baby, get ready. Across the field where the creek turns back by the old stump road, I'm gonna take you to a special place that nobody knows. Baby, get ready.
That is a really good camping song.
Yep, yeah, it's great.
We played that for many years and had a little bit of fun with it.
Perfect. Good dance music.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's got a good bit of a rhythm there going, hey?
Yeah.
So, Eckhart, being an outdoor guy, like, you don't just, I guess you can be born that way, or did you get influence from your parents? Like, were your parents hiking around Kitimat when
yes.
they had a chance?
Yes. Lots.
Yeah.
And it's a tough environment in Kitimat compared to Smithers because of the rain wall and that kind of stuff. But my mother on weekends had to get away from
yeah.
society and do her own thing.
Right.
You know, and coming from Europe, the forest there was pretty wrecked.
Well, there's just
Canada,
too many
forest,
people, hey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Canada, the forest was virgin.
Yeah,
you know,
which is
logging,
incredible.
Logging
yeah.
hadn't started yet in the 50s very much. So,
yeah, yeah.
So we really loved it.
No, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
One other thing, Eckhart, you had brothers and sisters, did you? Or
yeah,
do you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was two other brothers in my family. One of them is in Smithers, Dirk. Lots of people know him.
Yeah.
And he helped write a book on the ski hill and a few other books here. And then I had a sister that was in Squamish. She was older than we were.
Oh, yeah.
There was four children.
Right. Yeah. Okay, four children.
Yeah.
Squamish is a pretty nice recreational area also. Was
oh,
she
yeah.
an outdoor girl?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We're all avid skiers. Her family is their kids are all skiers too.
Right, right. That's pretty. That's pretty pretty cool setup there. And so then when you got into this forestry end, did you stay at that for quite a while, Eckhart?
Yeah, I did a lot of different jobs in the forestry, but I started at the bottom as a crew member, became a cruiser, and then eventually I wrote a forest officer exams, and I got called a technical forest officer 1 position,
right,
an official position from the government as assistant ranger in Hazleton in 1972.
Nice.
And I was taken off the crew. I already was married. And I got an official position, assistant ranger, where we were policing logging.
Right. And did you have like a ranger station that you were stationed at? Like that was
Yeah. We had where the old hospital is. So now there's a new hospital there.
Right.
But there was an old hospital there, and right beside that, the forestry had a station, and with some houses there, because housing, the wages were so low that you couldn't really afford to buy a house. So
right.
They give you a house to live on. Really cheaply to make up for the wages.
Right.
But I liked Hazleton, the Vietnam War was on.
Yeah.
So, of course, every weekend at the crossing where the garage is now, there was people headed out into the bush, Americans.
Right,
and,
right.
And one of the few trucks going by there that give people rides was my forestry truck.
Right, right. And there was quite a few draft dodgers went out the Kispiox Valley and lived into that country.
Yeah, they were, because it was fairly remote, and where the lodge is up now, where the Campbells lived later,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that area was just, you know, where the old telegraph line was, that was kind of just open country with some old cabins around there. Well, all those cabins in the 70s were filled with people.
Right, right.
And the government just sort of left things alone.
Yeah.
They couldn't remove them all.
Right, right. Now, one other guy I wanted to ask you a little bit about was Einar Blix. He was from Kitimat at one time.
Yeah.
Did you know him out there?
Yeah, he was an engineer in Kamano.
Oh, okay.
And we were good friends with him because we were all mountain people.
So, right.
And Einar actually lived in our house in Kitimat.
Oh, okay.
So we were actually, we had a house on Brant Street.
Right.
And Einar lived with us for a while.
Oh, okay.
And he had a separate apartment downstairs. So my mom was really good friends with him.
Right, yeah. He seemed like a pretty
We knew
his interesting
son.
Guy.
And then he started that Trails to the Interior book,
which
we all loved, of course.
Yeah,
There was all these trails around here, but Einar was the first guy that put it all together and organized it.
Yeah, yeah, which is something amazing, really, because it always takes somebody that can sit down and do the nitty-gritty work.
That's right.
And the rest of us are just fooling around enjoying it, you know?
Research every trail to put it on paper.
Oh, man, it's an amazing book. Yeah, that was called Trails to Timberline.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that's been redone a couple of times, and then there's a new version of it, too, that his son and him worked on before he passed away.
Oh, yeah, Andrew.
Yeah, yeah, so you knew him, too.
Andrew. Oh, yeah, we know him really well.
Right, right. That's very interesting, that for sure.
Yeah, we really looked up to him. He's a super neat guy.
He really is.
I went on a hike to him to Four Lakes Trail when he was already still on, when he was on crutches and stuff.
He
was still hiking.
Right.
He never quit. He never.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if he could still walk, he was hiking.
He would go. Yeah. Yeah, which is quite amazing.
Oh, he's amazing. Yeah.
And all these trails that he they were there, but he helped to make sure that they were still reconditioned. Reestablished.
Yeah, he did a bit of everything. It was always trying to find the trails, the old trails, and then trying to ribbon them out again so they could be used.
Yeah.
And then my mom was partly involved with some of those older trails, you know, and the trails were being lost. I mean, they were mostly old exploration trails from miners and stuff. And a lot of those trails were slowly being lost because there was no maintenance.
Yeah.
And so he helped do that.
Yeah.
You know, once he established where it was and found it all, it took weeks and weeks to find the old trails and then locate them again, you know, in the forest, and then draw that all on a map, a 4-mile-the-inch map.
It's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah.
And I mean, today, Eckhart, it's still, the trails are disappearing. You know, we constantly need to have people that want to put some effort into keeping them alive.
Oh, yeah, and even when I go on the trails now, I still am breaking all the branches off.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I remember the trail that goes through here.
Yeah,
I'm always trying to help it along a little bit.
Exactly.
But the stuff grows pretty fast.
Oh, man, does it ever. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay, Eckhart, my second song, now you've given me the lucky job of putting some songs together for our show, and so I've got a few that I are sort of related to fishing, and then a couple that are sort of related to fun. And so I've got this one now. This guy, Corb Blund, I don't know if you ever heard of him. He's actually from Alberta, and he's kind of a cowboy. He's got a couple songs on cows. But this one is called The Bible on the Dash. Now, just see what you think of this.
Jeez.
Two nights standing in Tulsa, pulling out and headed west. Brady grabbed the Gideons from the hotel in the desk, and we said, "What's the matter, brother? Are you worried about your soul?" He said, "Better safe than sorry, boys. That's just how I roll." We hit the road, feeling cool as Crosby, Stills, and Nash, overflowing with the spirit and the Bible on the dash. We pulled the whole thing over for the flashing red and blues. Police came to the window, we said, "Have you heard the news?" "Now don't get smart with me, boy, why you doing 95? My foot is heavy with redemption, I'm just blessed to be alive." He said, "I ought to pull you out of there, beat you black and blue." I placed my hand upon the good book, said, "What would Jesus do?" It's better than insurance, registration, or lying. It's better than these fake IDs I keep on buying. It's even better than an envelope stuffed with cash. Well, they always said it's in there, that old Bible on the dash. Around these parts, a hair low to make probable cause. If you're moving through my county, you'll obey my earthly laws. Yes, we did our best to quote some holy writ, chapter and verse. "What kind of music y'all's making?" We said, "Christian music, sir." He contemplated, thought about it, twirled his cop mustache. "All right, you boys, be careful now. Just don't drive quite so fast." It's better than insurance, registration, or lying. It's better than these fake IDs I keep on buying. It's even better than an envelope stuffed with cash. Well, they always said it's him in a Bible on the dash. Crossing at the border, a few months later, we heard, "Freeze, pull in over there, son, we gonna do some search and seize." Well, maybe if we'd been more famous, he'd have said, "Just move along." Yeah, if he'd have seen us on the TV. Or if we'd had hit single songs. He's just about to ask us, "Where's the money, guns, and hash?" Well, I was hoping it'd save me that old Bible on the dash. Well, his hand was on his pistol and his dog was on his leash. And that shepherd, he was keeping a pretty close eye on his sheep. We got a list we gonna look at, see if we can't find your names. And we got parabolic laser beams, here's everything you say. We got ultraviolet x-rays that can see right through your bus. I guess we'll see if the good Lord's truly watching over us. It's better than a green card, it's better than lying. It's better than these work visas I keep on buying. It's even better than an envelope stuffed with cash. Lord, I'm at the border with the Bible on the dash.
So that is Corb Blund, and he's a very cool guy. Played in Smithers, come out here, and he's got quite a following out in Alberta. And part of our little go-to thing is we try to have one Canadian on, on our little song list.
Yep.
So he's our number one, but I think I might have another one. So we'll see how that goes. So Eckhart, the going back now to the part of your sort of, I would say your life is this fishing part. Now, how did you get hooked on fishing? Did you start in Kitimat like by going in the ocean and that type of fishing and kind of get a liking for it?
No, my parents wanted to preserve the outdoors. I had a different view. My goal was that we could live off of the outdoors.
Right.
So even though my parents were against my hunting and fishing activities their whole lives, they did like the meat I brought home and the fish I brought home. And,
right.
And there was a few of us young guys that were avid fishermen that biked down to the Kitimat River Bridge all the time when we were from 6 years old. I had to be able to swim before I could go fishing. I remember my mom wouldn't let us go and we could swim.
Right,
until we could
right.
Swim. So I'd come home. We were allowed 12 trout a day.
Holy smokes.
So I'd have my bike. I had 12 trout lined up on my bike.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, mostly cutthroats. So you run cutthroat, maybe 30 to 30 centimeters long.
Yeah.
I'd bring them home every weekend, and my parents would love eating them.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
But they were always, my mom was a real conservationist even later in her life in Smithers.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't endorse my hobby that much.
Right.
She liked eating them, but she always felt sorry for the fish.
Yeah, that's right. That's interesting. So your growth of that, would that be expanded while you were in Smithers? Like, did you went?
I lived for a while, I got a couple promotions. I got a promotion to terrace at one point on the Kalem River. It was, this was in the early 80s, and we were still allowed to kill steelhead at that time, and we were good at it. We were young forestry guys. We'd snowshoe into the old 10-mile, the Nass Road, Nass Road. And we were good at killing steelhead, and we brought back, in retrospect, way too many steelhead.
Yeah.
Way too many. And later on, of course, we went to catch and release in almost all the places.
Yeah, now, just speaking about catch and release while we brought it up, though, is it really a good thing?
It really is. When you do a lot of fishing and you get good at it, you can catch quite a few fish in a season. I certainly do that. And catch and release for steelhead, we've done lots of research on it. I was a member of the Steelhead Society for years and years. And the kill ratio of steelhead is very low. Even badly hooked steelhead almost always survive. Different than salmon, spring salmon and other salmon, where the kill ratio is usually around 15%.
Right.
But in steelhead, it's as low as 5% or less.
Oh, I see.
So catch and release, it doesn't hurt the fish. Some of them, there's some mortality with all of that.
Yeah.
A very low amount, though.
Yeah.
But we have, I mean, even years right now with quite a few steelhead in the Bulky River. Not every year, but lots of years. It's quite good fishing.
Well, do the steelhead hang around? Like, do they go to the ocean and come back? Or what is their life cycle?
Yes, they do. Not too often, but they've had some steelhead here. I mean, they've been tagged and caught three or four times over 3 or 4 years. And all the other salmon that we have, they die when they spawn. And they are the only ones that don't.
Right.
I mean, some other fish, like bull trout, don't die when they spawn. And sea run cutthroat don't die when they spawn. But they're not that common for targets for us.
Right. I mean? Right.
But
right.
Certainly, and coas, of course, is what a lot of people nowadays are after, including the Taco River and areas.
Right.
Some of those areas were closed years ago, and just recently they've opened opportunities, like for fishing coas in the Taco River. Taco River was always closed before.
Right,
we were allowed to fish, and now we can fish there, of course.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, let's continue this conversation after usually around midway in the show. We have a station identification moment, and we also have a little shout-out to our sponsors, so we'll just take a little break through that. I know you're talking quite a bit. You probably need some water.
No, I'm good.
I'm just kidding. Anyways, okay, so as we know, we're on Smithers Community Radio, and we call ourselves CICK, and we are 93.9 on your FM dial. So The other thing that we like to do is kind of have a mention of our sponsors. On my show, I usually mention the bronze sponsors, and they're part of a group of people that are actually helping us out because we're a volunteer-run organization, and there always never seems to be enough money around to keep us going, but we're hanging in. This is our 15th year. So I'd like to have a shout-out to Counting on Broadway and Ranch House Tattoo. We've also got BV Farmers Market and Classic Sanitary, and we've also got the BV Concert Association. They're in full swing right now with their winter concerts. And we also have Bugwood Bean and Phoenix Self-Care Studio. So my name is Thomas Tom Roper, and my program is On the Ropes. And tonight we have a Smithers. I call him Smithers, though he does live out of town, but he's a smithereen fisherman, Eckert Mendel. Welcome aboard, Eckert.
Thank you. Thank you. This was fun.
Yeah, we're having a little bit of fun. So swinging back to the fish situation. Now, this is a, you know, talking about catch and release and the fish that are available. One of my biggest concerns is any damage of habitat. And we just had a meeting last week with a coal company that wants to put a coal mine, develop a coal mine 7 kilometers from Telqua, basically on the Goathorn Creek watershed, which of course flows into the Telqua River. What's your feeling on that, Eckert, as a fisherman? Do you have any concerns? Do the fisher people feel any concern at all?
Well, I think we're all worried about water volume, for one, because Elkan tried to get the bulky meat way smaller, and number two is, of course, water quality. I mean, any disturbance of soils or any disturbance everywhere nowadays, whether you're logging, whether you're building logging roads, whether you're building a dike, anything, does affect water quality. And most people don't know that, but when water is very silty and affected by quality, and not only pollution from that way, but also silt pollution, it clogs up the gills of the fish and eventually will kill them. And, of course, there's also the mechanical disturbance of steelhead. They live in the big pools, and in the winter, they have to survive the spring. They come up in the fall, stay in pools and stuff in the bulky river, in the deeper pools, as long as there's not ice. And then in the spring, they spawn, and they try and go back to the ocean to redo that. Some of them do achieve that 4 or 5 times, but probably about 3 times is normal. They go back, and they're the only fish really that goes back to spawn to the ocean that doesn't die. Well, but water quality is really important to them, and certainly the Telqua River has steelhead and cohos and other trout. I mean bull trout and
right.
Cutthroat and other fish in it too. But any change of the water quality or increase in siltation of rivers and creeks like Goathorn Creek would, of course, be detrimental to the fish.
Right.
Never mind the importance of fishing, because as there's less and less fish, I mean, fishermen get cut back too. And that's happened a lot already. We know that.
Right. One thing I was wondering about when they were talking about salmon going to the ocean and then returning to spawn, and they're saying that out of, you know, the millions of fries that are produced on a river, the percentage of return is extremely small, because everybody wants that fish. They want it out in the ocean. The other species want to eat it, the seals, the whales, whoever can get their hands on it. So the return is very small. How do they feel about the steelhead return? Like, if there's only so many steelhead and they get out in the ocean, how many are really coming back?
That's a good question, and certainly the answer to that is tough. Fisheries hasn't figured it out, and we certainly haven't figured it out.
Yeah.
Ocean survival is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And there's been lots of work done on ocean survival, but we're very poor at estimating the returns of steelhead. We're extremely poor at it. We're better at other salmon, where we can do a computer profile of them for sockeye and other fish, but steelhead doesn't fit into any of those profiles. And so it's really tough to estimate numbers of steelhead every year in the Berkeley. The highs are up to 30,000 on really good years, and the lows are 8,000.
Right.
Somewhere like that.
Yeah.
This year, I think, was moderate. I mean, I talk to a lot of people, and I fish a lot. And this year, some people did really good. Some people did really poor. But that's kind of normal when you talk to a number of people.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the other thing I was wondering about, Eckhart, is whenever I've spoken to you or heard from other people that I know that have been fishing with you or talked about it, you have your own areas that you like to go, and you've spent quite a bit of time up in the Telegraph Creek area. Is that one of your favorite areas? Would you put that in there?
Yes, it is. As you get northern, further north, the environment for steelhead isn't as good. The fish are smaller. There's less fish. The rivers are smaller, too, as you get on the Upper Nass, and the Stikine River has a bunch of tributaries going down from Telegraph Creek, and I fish most of them with the boat. And they're steelhead in all those rivers up there, but they're quite a bit smaller. A lot of the fish are below 10 pounds. And they're not fished very much up there because the areas are very remote.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to get to them. There's a few guides with helicopters and beaver aircraft and flying around too. But I fished really remote areas. I tried to, when I was a guide up there, I tried to make the bush fun for people, for Europeans, but they didn't know what fun was in nature.
Right.
I had to teach people that were going fishing with me what fun was. And the year after that, in the winter, when they were sitting at their offices in Europe somewhere, then they realized how much fun it was, and they pulled me a gat. Can we go back to that spot where there was no people?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
You have to teach people how to have fun in nature.
Yeah, which is very interesting. And the fact, and European people, they have this, they live with this situation where there's just too many people.
Yeah.
And so they, whenever they can get out, once they can understand living without people, I mean, it must be a little bit, I've heard people say that before, you know, that they like to rub shoulders with people. They like to be in town, you know, but that's not the way we want to be. We like to be sort of alone.
We consider it the most fun when we're alone or almost alone. And it takes a while to learn that.
Yeah.
We know that because we live here. But Europeans don't know that. But once they've been here a couple of times and they're fishing at a remote river catching some fish and there's nobody else there, then they pretty soon find how nice that is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's slip another song in here, Eckhart. And this is one of our favorite guys. We call him the Smithers Troubadour. And he's been around probably as long as we have. He was born here, Mark Perry. And I had the privilege this summer. I was very fortunate to go with him on the Skeena. And we were on a jet boat from Terrace up to Rupert. When I really, my goal was to see Port Essington. I'd never seen it, and I'd never seen the mouth of the Skeena.
Yeah.
You know, being that it's Rupert's
side,
a little off there.
Yeah.
So I was very happy to do that. And then we got to stay at the Cassiar Cannery, which is a extremely historic spot, and rub shoulders with Mark Perry. So I don't know how it could get much better.
Yeah.
So that song, you told me one time before that you like to dance, and some of Mark Perry's are kind of more ballad-like. But this one is kind of brings back the memories of the High Road people.
This is the place that I want to stay. drifted right in. Now he's a man with a permanent grin, and he can dance all night. He can dance all night. High road people can dance all night. I got a rusty K-car with a muffled on. Well, it rattles and it shakes and it won't last long. Well, I'm gonna drive down to the Glenwood Hall. I'm gonna park it in the lot and laugh about it all. I mean, what else am I gonna do? Well, I can dance all night. Yeah, I can dance all night. High road people can dance all night. And we can dance all night. We can dance all night. High road people 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 can dance all night. And high road people can dance all night.
Well, that was one of my favorite guys. We actually call ourselves groupies. We've kind of followed him around when he plays in Rupert. We've taken a couple trips up there, and he's a pretty cool guy.
Yeah. And that's good dance music.
That some of it's good. Some of it
that
is.
That song is great.
Yeah, that's a good listening. Good summer listeners. But so Eckert, we could go on quite a bit about fishing, and I do want to continue that. But I also want to ask you. Like, I don't consider you a one-dimensional guy. You're not just a fisherman. You've got other interests and hobbies. And can you tell me a little bit about one of your other sort of sidelines that you like to work on?
Well, I've tried to do a lot of things in my life. I've had about 10 different jobs. I've been a scuba diver, professional scuba diver, working for Canfor, did the bubble system out there for years. Huckleberry Reach. I also did work for Huckleberry out there as a scuba diver. I'm one of the only guys that has had a lifelong interest in underwater stuff. Originally as a pleasure diver, and later as an instructor, and then later as a professional diver and doing jobs around here. Around Rupert, around Kitimat. I lived for years in Haida Gwaii, and I did lots of scuba diving there. Diving has always been a favorite hobby of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I still have a compressor in my house and 10 tanks, and I'm getting close to 80.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's pretty cool.
I've done lots of stuff in my life, and I've always enjoyed going to work.
Yeah.
Work. I love work.
Yeah. And now we don't work, but we have to kind of, what I've tried to do is retool. That's the way I call it. You know, there's things we can do.
Yeah.
We just aren't making money at what we're doing.
Of course.
A little bit of fun at it, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't actually thinking of your scuba diving. I forgot about that because I think you actually, did you not dive a little bit with Mark Wormerdam and
we had a bunch of people here that took up diving.
Right.
And we would go to Haida Gwaii for 10 days of diving. And Haida Gwaii is interesting. It's pretty virgin underwater there.
Right.
And there's good things to eat there, too.
Yeah. No, that's the amazing thing about ocean is that you never really run out of food there because it's just incredible.
Yeah,
incredible.
And we saw neat things underwater there.
Yeah. Yeah, I can imagine.
And it doesn't cost a lot. You could go there with a small boat. You didn't have to go way out in the ocean. You didn't need a big multi-million boat. We just had 14-foot boats and had our own compressor on the beach. And
Exactly, yeah. Well, that sounds pretty cool. Now, have you... one time I had a job working for Silver Grizzly out of Rupert. and they were helicopter loggers. And they had their own barge set in the work channel. Have you spent any time up in that work channel?
I've been there a couple of times with my boat. I've been diving there a couple of times. Diving wasn't very good underwater. We don't really know why. It wasn't disturbed and it wasn't polluted, but there just wasn't a lot of active marine life there. But you have to remember, Work Channel has been occupied by people for
200 years.
Yeah, 200 years. And First Nations people, as well as the Antioch mine there, as well as, it was quite a famous area a long time ago for fishing. Fishing is still good there, but the underwater environment is not really alive like it is at Haida Gwaii, like it is out of Kitimat, further out at Douglas Channel.
Right.
It's, I mean, everything looks okay, but you just don't see a lot of abalone, you don't see a lot of rock scallops, you don't see a lot of sea urchins, you don't see a lot of sea cucumbers. You don't just see a lot of stuff.
Right.
I mean, it looks all good. What you see is all good, but just not a lot of variety.
Right. 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 I see. I
mean, there's lots of other places out of Rupert and that are way more alive underwater.
Right.
Than Work Channel. But it is good fishing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's sort of the main part about it.
Yeah.
Now, when I was leading that question to you, I actually was thinking more of your reading ability and your history ability as a hobby. These are another sort of part of your makeup.
Yeah. What my interest is what's really interesting is when First Nations people and white people first got together here, which was in the late 1700s, the first history of that is really interesting. And I really love that part of I read the books I can and learn as much as I can about it, you know. And for me, it's really interesting because it wasn't that long ago that the Spaniards and the English and that came to our coast.
Right.
I mean, Mr. Vancouver and Mr. Cook.
Right.
And those times are really super interesting.
This seemed that way. Yeah. Now, when I worked up at Huckleberry, Eckert, there was a spot there, a mountain not too far from where we had the pit. It was called the Cibola. And I'd been struggling to find out where that Spanish word would have come from. And lately I've just read that book on Catiline, and a lot of the packers back in the day, they started out, this whole gold rush started out in California in 1850, and a lot of the packers were Mexican. And as the rush came north, they came with the work. And so they ended up in British Columbia. There's quite a few places where Mexicans have actually settled. And so the Spanish language would always get passed around. You know, we get that with all languages, German, French, and we have different words that fit into our English vocabulary. But I found that very interesting, that situation was going on. And Catiline, this guy, we've just been started to get a little bit of interest in him because we were looking for his gravestone. And when we found it, somebody had stole the plaque. So we wanted to put a new plaque on there. And so I've read a couple books on him, and a very interesting guy as a horse packer. And if you think about when you're talking about when the white man and the natives got together, you're saying 1700. Well, right here in Hazelton, right in our backyard here, there was no roads, you know, in 1900. And this was the years of the paddle wheeler. So the boat would arrive in Hazelton, and somebody had to move those goods, and he was the guy.
Yeah.
And I get so excited reading about that kind of stuff. I don't know about you. That's sort of your kind of take on it too, Eckert?
Yeah, and I mean he was an interesting guy. I mean, he couldn't speak much English, but he was well liked, and he had this incredible record of doing a good job. Everything that you wanted moved, he could move it, and he always got to where he was wanted to go.
Yeah,
you know, and they were mostly, I think, being paid by the pound for moving.
Yeah, that's right. There was
And there was three or four of them packing between Quesnel and Hazelton, but Hazelton was a big jumping off spot.
It was a major spot.
Yeah, it was major.
Yeah, so it's kind of we're kind of I feel like we're in history. You know, we live right in it, and I get kind of excited about that part.
Well, compared to Europe, where I'm from, our history is so young.
That
we still know some of the people, or the relatives of the people that made the history.
Yeah, you can like just reach out for it.
The Allens up in the Kisbeaux and the Campbells, and I mean these old families. Their grandchildren are around now.
Yeah,
but it wasn't very long ago when they were first, second generation.
Yeah,
people, and they're still, and the Kisbeaux is still full of old names.
Yeah, exactly.
And Telegraph Creek certainly more so.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I would like to squeeze in one more song. Eckhart, we're doing really good. Our time is plugging by, and this is one. This is a fishing song that I kind of thought you might like. It's not as fast as I know you like to go, but it's got some good words to it. So we'll give it a go.
Well, I love her, but I love to fish. I spend all day out on this lake, and hell is all I catch. But today she met me at the door, said I would have to choose. If I hit that fishing hole today, she'd be packing all her things and she be gone by noon. Well, I'm gonna miss her when I get home. Right now I'm on this lake shore, and I'm sitting in the sun. I'm sure when I walk through that door tonight, yeah, I'm gonna miss her. Oh, looky there, I've got a bite, all right. If I hurry, I could beg her to stay. That water's right and the weather's perfect. No telling what I might catch today. So I'm gonna miss her when I get home. But right now lake shore, and I'm sitting in the sun. I'm sure it'll hit me when I walk through that door tonight. Yeah, I'm gonna miss her. Oh, looky there, another bite. Yeah, I'm gonna miss her. Oh, looky there, I've got a bite.
That's an old country classic by Brad Paisley. It's been around for a while, but it's kind of a fun fishing song.
sounds great. It's hard to find songs about fishing, eh?
Yeah, well... This thing with Spotify, this is one of the fun things I like about the show. I can go on there, and if you write in fishing songs, they'll pull up 100 of them for you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're all over the place. Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's kind of cool.
Sorry, I thought you had to listen to 1,000 of them.
Listen to them and see if it's one I like, fits into what I sort of like the sound of it.
Okay.
But anyways, so Eckhart, I know that you've spent a lot of time doing different jobs, like you talked about the diving, and then at one time, I think you were involved in helping people with their septic systems And I was really kind of, those are the types of things that sort of impressed me, is that you, at a certain age, you weren't afraid to go and learn, figure out what requirements were needed so that you could do that job and get yourself a piece of equipment and go out and create an income for yourself.
Yeah, I didn't really look for an income to do that, but I liked there wasn't many people that were good at doing septic stuff.
No.
Everybody shied away from it.
Yeah.
But it's actually a really good job. And you do, I mean, I went to school for over a couple of years to learn about it.
Right.
I took way more courses than what I need to learn about pathogens and stuff in wastewater.
Right.
And later, I became a bit of a guy here that was teaching other kids to do that, to get their tickets. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, it was great. And it's a good way to start being in private business for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody should do that in their lives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You definitely...
And it was great. Now we've got a few new people doing it, the younger people doing it.
I'm
getting a little old, but they still phone me every week or two. If they have a bit of a problem, I still help out.
Right, right. That seems to be part of your nature, for sure.
I love it.
One other thing... that I kind of wanted to, well, is that, I mean, it could go on quite a while tonight. We could probably do a second show, but I'm always thinking about the way we kind of run things. My wife and I, we sort of have like a 5-year plan. We call it the Russian 5-year plan. And we just recently were coming to the end of this one where we sold out our farm and we moved to town, found a place and got ourselves organized. And now we're going to, as part of our plan, is we'd like to travel for a couple of years. Have you ever thought of traveling? Like, have you been back to Germany, or do you feel any excitement about traveling?
I've been back to Germany a couple of times. The trouble is, I love it here, and I don't really need to take off in the winter because I like skiing a lot.
Yeah.
I've learned to make to like all seasons in Smithers.
Yeah.
And Smithers is a great town for that. I have lots of friends that go to Mexico every winter, and there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
It's not for me. I like the north.
Yeah. And we like winter.
That's right. I love it. Winter's a long time here, so you have to have fun in the winter.
Yeah.
If you do things here that have fun in the winter, I mean, sure, it's nice to go in the hot sunshine for a while, but I'm very active. I like doing backcountry skiing.
Yeah.
If I need something to do, I can find something pretty quick in Smithers and enjoy it.
Exactly. You know. Exactly. Well, that's now the other question I wanted to just get in there before we conclude ourselves down is, you must be a good cook. Like, being that you've been out in the outdoors a lot, you catch a lot of fish, there must be different techniques that you've developed over the years in the cooking world.
Yes, when I was guiding, I guided for 10 years Europeans, and you learn how to cook for other people. That's exactly the menu that you like. But at a personal level, I mean, you know, I like moose meat. I like fish. I'm good at eating lots of things. And a lot of native foods that my mom used to cook it. Native foods from the Heislas and Kitimat. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can eat. I like wild mushrooms. I'm not an expert at it, but Germans seem to have a passion for wild mushrooms. So when we go fishing and that, we pick wild mushrooms. And one of the problems with moose meat is it takes a long time to cook it, so it's hard to cook it on a camping trip.
Right.
Have to cook it at home and take it with you.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I have portions frozen in my deep freeze. When I go out to trip for fishing for 2 days, I take a container of pre-cooked moose out that's tender, been cooked in the slow cooker for a day.
Perfect.
And take that with me. I know how to cook, but I'm more of a bush guy. I like fishing better than cooking. But when I had lots of people, my wife used to come. She's a better cook than I am. She used to come and help me out cooking. And before, the people would, my customers would say, "Oh, Eckert, that's really good. That's really good fishing." But when my wife went there, they said, "Oh, man, the food was really good."
Yeah, exactly.
They would comment secondary about the fishing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, that's pretty cool. Okay, Eckert, well, we're kind of come to our time frame. We're trying to make it within an hour because they've always got somebody lined up to come on the next hour. So I'd like to say thank you very much for coming out tonight. We really given us a chance to learn a little bit more about you. And
Tom, I think I've had more fun than you have.
No, I don't know if you have or not.
Yes, Tom, I appreciate you doing this, Tom.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
It's great.
Yeah, and so I've got the other thing that I normally do here, it looks like I'm not prepared, is I don't have my outro ready to go, and it's just really saying the same thing that I like to repeat is I appreciate the listeners, and I like my little comment of we'll see you on the flip side. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
We'll push that off now. Let's see if we can find that there.